The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. After Remainers found new hope with the Chequer summit, the hard Brexiters strike back.
Could the Prime Minister inform the House at what point it was decided that Brexit means Remain?
Prime Minister!
As rebellions break out on all sides of the party, the government caves in to Jacob Rees-Mogg's Brexiters, and as votes go down to the wire, Labour MPs keep May afloat. Also this week, members of the Vote Leave campaign face criminal charges over spending irregularities. And we'll hear from our Washington bureau chief, David Smith, as America reels from the Putin-Trump summit.
President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
But first, it's been a febrile atmosphere in the last full week of Parliament before the summer break. Theresa May faced a series of votes on two key Brexit bills on customs and trade. No sooner has she quelled a Brexiteer rebellion with some early concessions than the Remain wing of her party went on manoeuvres against her. In the end, she squeaked through a series of nail-biting divisions and lives to fight another day. Well, to discuss it all, I'm joined here by my panel, our political correspondent Jessica Elgott, Jonathan Liss of British Influence, and The Spectator's Katie Balls. Jess, you were in the lobby for the excitement earlier in the week. Was there ever a chance the government could lose one of these votes?
Yeah, I think there was absolutely a chance that the government could have lost one of the votes. And there's so many sort of little moments of drama around it, which meant that they didn't lose them. So, for example, two Lib Dems, Vince Cable and Tim Farron, thought that the vote wasn't going to be close, so they didn't turn up. You know, there were Labour MPs who weren't there on the day. Some of them might have had some other reasons. And, you know, it really was, you know, there was a sort of three or four votes in it. So there was quite a lot that could have happened to make it go one way or the other. And I don't think the Tories thought it was going to be as close as it was, which made it even more dramatic the next day when the votes were close again. And we hear then again that there was some, you know, that there was with Jo Swinson, who was a Lib Dem MP who's just had a baby. She was supposed to be paired, this kind of convention where, you know, there's a bit of a gentleman's agreement between two parties that someone else would abstain if someone has to stay away. And her pair, Brandon Lewis, the chair of the Conservative Party, turned up and voted anyway. So there's been all these kind of things that could have meant that things could have gone very, very differently.
And Katie, she emerges to some extent, not strengthened Theresa May. She's still clinging on, but where she's quite boxed in, isn't she?
I think
to say the least.
Yeah, that's quite a kind way of summing it up. I think she's slightly less weak than it appeared she might be on Tuesday afternoon. but that's the high praise from The Spectator. She's in a terrible place, really. She played this big Brexit gamble, probably her second biggest gamble since the snap election, which didn't go well.
This is the Chequers agreement.
Where she revealed her Brexit hand, put her proposals out there, a softer Brexit than many in her party would like. Thought, initially that was going to land okay, begrudgingly by some. But since then, it's just all unravelled. You had all these front bench resignations and all just mounting disquiet and, you know, within the party and anger at her position. And I do think this week it's just felt completely chaotic and like the government have lost control. There were points on Tuesday afternoon ahead of the customs union amendment vote when you really had people thinking they were going to lose it and working out what they would be doing. And I think had they lost that vote, Theresa May would be currently facing a no-confidence vote.
She even tried to bring forward the summer recess, didn't she? It's just a bit of a sign of desperation when you find yourself declaring an early holiday.
Exactly. And also it tells you something when your boss can't actually give their staff, it's not technical stuff, but you can't give your party an early holiday. You know, something's going wrong in the morale stakes. But I think the strangest thing about the recess thing is all the MPs were ready on a one-line whip for next week. So not much was going to be happening. So the only reason really that you would want to formalise it and end the recess would be because if Parliament's not sitting, it's much harder to mount a leadership challenge or have a no-confidence vote.
So it's to send the plotters away, really, rather than
exactly
anything else. Jonathan, what does it mean after these votes? So the government made a series of concessions, didn't it, to Jacob Rees-Mogg and his pals, and, you know, then managed to get through the other bill without having to make any concessions. What does this mean for the kind of Brexit that we end up with and for that Chequers deal?
This is a high watermark for the government. This is as good as it gets for them. They've avoided a no confidence vote. They've avoided possibly an early general election. That's why the votes are so close. And like Katie says, it's like at the end of term feeling when you've just failed your exams, so you don't want to draw out the agony of waiting to hear the results. But what we get from now is, because now Parliament has sort of voted effectively to leave the customs union, it's tied the government's hands in a way that the Brexiteers always said should never be done. So we have two scenarios now. Either we go for a no deal scenario, because the EU will not, cannot accept checkers for two reasons. The Max Facilitation Partnership, or whatever they're calling it now, there has to be a customs union in Northern Ireland. That's the end. And also because of the single market being split, May asking for single marketing goods and not in services, capital, or importantly, people. So either we go for a no deal scenario, which is totally impossible politically, legally, socially, economically, or the government accepts that we need to be in a customs union and has to go back to Parliament with its tail between its legs in October, says, would you mind awfully unravelling these amendments and actually voting for customs union after all? And they'll be whipped to do that. I mean, there is really no way out of it apart from that.
Is there a majority in Parliament for any kind of approach now, do you think, Katie? It doesn't seem to be a majority really for the Chequers approach. There's probably not a majority for no deal, because as Jonathan says, a lot of MPs think it would be disastrous.
I think there's no majority right now for any form of Brexit or no Brexit. There's no agreement on anything. I think there's two things that are interesting and could change it. So at the moment, you have lots of people saying on both sides that they would not vote for May's Brexit deal, even if she got the Chequers agreement exactly as she wanted, which is a big, big if, they still wouldn't vote for it. And that is Brexiteers on one side and Remainers on the other side. Now, that's because both sides can't decide what it means if they vote down that deal. Are you heading to a no deal scenario, or are you heading to no Brexit? So I think if that becomes clearer, if we know what the other option really is, then you might have one side say they'll vote for the deal. And I think the only other way, I think Theresa May might get people to vote for her deal, something I said earlier in the week, and which is, I think she needs to get out there and start talking to voters, not her MPs, because her MPs are never going to agree on this. The Tory party has been divided on Europe for decades. You know, it's not going to be the case that she can get Anna Soubry to agree with Jacob Rees-Mogg, but if she can get voters to agree with her compromise, to decide that this is the best way of honouring the result, they might have to represent their constituents.
The point is, we have to get clear what May's deal actually means, because Chequers cannot be accepted by the EU, which means that May's deal is either the full single market and full customs union, or it's a split border in the Irish Sea between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, both of which will be unacceptable to MPs. So if we have a soft Brexit scenario, which seems a bit likely because that's the direction of travel, that won't be acceptable to Leavers or Remainers, because it gives us maximum integration with the EU, but in absolutely no say in how that manifests itself. And so that's why Justin Greening has now called for a people's vote, for example. I think that a vote, a referendum, is going to be a lot likelier.
That's one option, isn't it, Jess, to throw it open to the country, although would that deliver any clearer an answer?
I mean, so I think it's more, I would have said maybe 2 months ago that I thought a second referendum, there was pretty much zero chance of a second referendum. I think it's more likely now, but I still don't really see how it works in practice. I mean, to get the first referendum through, we had to have almost 7 months worth of legislation to get a referendum in place. And then when if there's a referendum, what does it say? It's clearly going to, and the people's vote want it to be a, you know, deal or remain. That is clearly never, ever going to be acceptable to, I think, probably the majority of MPs in Parliament. I don't think they would accept that version of it. So if there was to be another one, do you have this kind of three-way choice, which is what Justin Greening has suggested, that you kind of then have two choices between deal, no deal, and no Brexit, and then narrow it down to two and choose between the two. The problem with that is that you risk the public voting for no deal, which is could be absolutely catastrophic. So I do think that, you know, it's probably more likely, but there's a lot of really mad unknowns that before we could get there.
And I do think on this idea of a second referendum, lots of people in the People's Vote campaign think this would be a way to solve it. But I think you'll get such a backlash from voters who voted for Leave and feel like they haven't been listened to, their concerns haven't gone anywhere. And actually, there's already an idea being fueled that this is an establishment stitch-up.
Boris Johnson was busy fueling that idea yesterday, wasn't he? Betrayal narrative.
Exactly, in his big resignation state. So you have people who were in government up to very recently saying this is Brexit in name only. So I do think if we have a referendum, the result will be something that a lot of people who think it's a good idea won't like.
I think that's an absolutely fair risk, but Boris Johnson's actually quite a good person to listen to at the moment, because he's basically making the Remainers argument for us. He's saying that the government has gone from a position of saying we need maximum freedom to saying that we need to accept these rules wholesale without having any say in them. How can that possibly be sustainable to Leavers or to Remainers? And so if we get to this final situation where everyone hates it, and no one can accept that sort of compromise, then there might well be an appetite in the country to actually reconsider the decision. Because, as Katie says, Leavers are going to be furious whatever happens. So we might as well have people being furious and not also catastrophically poorer.
I think if we've learned anything at all about the British public during this whole debacle over the last 2 years, it's that Mays, if you had to pick between the politician's deal and something else, either no deal or remain, I'm pretty sure I know which one would come last, just because that's how people are.
And we should talk about Boris's resignation speech, shouldn't we, Jess? You were watching it yesterday. There was a lot of chatter in the run-up about would it be like Geoffrey Howe's very famous, you know, sort of glorious resignation speech in 1990 that triggered the series of events that led to Margaret Thatcher's downfall. Was it a great moment?
I think it wasn't possibly as great a moment as he thought it might be. He'd kind of packed in a lot of people, supporters around, and there was the real kind of hardline Brexiteers around him, people like Andrew Bridge and Andrea Jenkins. They're all sat in a circle around him. David Davis, his other departed cabinet colleague, was just sat just behind him. And he said, you know, it's not too late to save Brexit. He made this sort of passionate plea to go back to what May had sort of initially set out in some of her earlier speeches, that we should have a free trade agreement and have the freedom with the EU, and then have the freedom to strike a lot of deals elsewhere without binding ourselves to any EU rules. But he didn't go so far as to call for her to go. He kept saying that it should be about changing the policy. And even there was a sort of slight dig that I thought found really interesting, where he sort of had a bit of a dig at his cabinet colleagues who'd stayed, saying they think it's fine to just change the policy afterwards. I think it was like break the bone and then reset it. And I don't agree. And I think that's a real kind of dig at Michael Gove and Liam Fox, who are sort of privately making some of those arguments. But was it a great moment? It's made the front of most national newspapers, but I think maybe it was always going to. And now that Boris has done this speech, and he's done his column, he's done his speech, and he's got kind of, it's like, what's now? What's next? What is it that comes next? And we don't know.
Katie, is he still a potential leadership contender, or is that moment long past, do you think?
I think he is. I think there's still many reasons you can say he wouldn't be a good one. You could make that argument. But I think he definitely is. If he could get to the members. So the question is, would he get enough MPs to get behind him in the way the Tory leadership contest worked? Because it's, unlike Labour's, it's much more down to the parliamentary party, and you lose one person around. So could he get to the final two? If he got to the final two, I think by far he'd be the grassroots choice, unless Jacob Rees-Mogg was also there. But I don't think Jacob Rees-Mogg has a desire or would get to that. So I think Boris, if he can get there, would be there. And I also think, if you looked at that speech, it didn't seem like he wanted to, you know, eviscerate Theresa May now. But it did beg the question that Theresa May has made perfectly clear that she has no plans of budging on her policy.
It's personally associated with her, isn't it? It's her deal,
exactly.
It's her policy.
And she's doubled down. She said it numerous times. Number 10 are doing everything they can to try and keep it alive, to varying degrees of success. So she's not going to suddenly go and take Boris's tack. So that does mean, if this continues, and then in a few months' time, the EU coming back asking for more concessions, is that when they mount the leadership challenge with a no-confidence vote? Because I don't think, for all of Boris's speech saying he wants, he admires the Prime Minister but just disagrees with his policy, is not really compatible with her staying in the post long term from his perspective.
So he's laying down a marker for the future rather than sending his troops over the top.
Definitely. I think this is part of a long campaign.
What I would say about Johnson is that the figure may not be him, but certainly the mark has been laid down for hardening of Brexit. And so what we have now is May sort of chained to a pole, if you like, and being pulled in two very different directions, because Parliament is going to pull her into a harder position, because what we've seen is that the Brexiteers are much stronger and much more prepared to rebel than the Tory Remainers. So you're going to have a Parliament pressure to pull her in a harder Brexit. But of course, the EU is only going to be pulling her towards this softer position, which is the full single market and customs union. And so there is nowhere for her to go. And so even if it doesn't come in the figure of Boris Johnson, it's impossible to see how she can remain a post beyond October or November.
Jess, it's well worth saying the Labour Party's not entirely united on this, is it? They've tried to focus on Tory divisions, but
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's certainly one of the reasons why the government didn't fall on Tuesday night is because there were Labour MPs who voted with the government despite the intense efforts of Labour whips and Labour front benches, including, you know, some really Eurosceptic ones. We hear that John McDonnell was one of the ones going to them individually and saying, please, you know, this is our chance, possibly for a general election, and they still wouldn't budge. And if they won't budge for that, you can't imagine, you know, that they'll budge for anything. And there are also, you know, there's quite a few on this sort of ultra Remain side. They outnumber the Labour Brexiteers, but whether those people might be prepared if they think that if the UK is heading for a no deal scenario, would they then think that it might be better to back the Prime Minister? That's certainly not going to be the Labour front bench position, but could some MPs get there? I think there's certainly a number that could.
Well, earlier in Westminster, I caught up with Labour's Shadow Brexit Secretary Keir Starmer and asked him how concerned he was about that handful of Labour MPs who voted with the government.
Well, that's true, but you can't live night by night, vote by vote, winning by three on Monday, winning again by three on Monday, losing by six on Monday on one vote, winning by six in the following vote. You can't keep that up for 6 months. The margins are too narrow now, and therefore she really is teetering now, and it is very difficult to see how she goes forward. But from our point of view, we have got to put the Tory civil war on one side. You know, this war within the Tory party has been going on for 30 plus years. They've been at each other over Europe. It's brought down three of their previous prime ministers, could well bring down this prime minister. And all we've seen this week is that war on their benches. It was always threatening to break out. It's broken out big time now. In the past, it was contained within the Tory party. Now it's threatening the future of the country and it's getting really serious.
Won't they bank on the fact that quite a few Labour MPs ultimately, when a deal comes back to the Commons, if she gets a deal, won't want to be seen to be blocking Brexit and will worry that the only alternative is a no-deal Brexit, which they would see as quite disastrous?
Well, there is a concern, a grave concern about no-deal, and I share it, because I think no-deal will be absolutely disastrous, and I think those that are casual about it, even espouse it, have not actually thought through the consequences of no-deal. But I am convinced that this Parliament will not allow no deal to be the outcome. If the Prime Minister's Article 50 deal is voted down, or she comes back and says, I haven't been able to reach agreement, I think this Parliament will take control at that stage and say that is simply not acceptable for our country, and that the majority in Parliament will then come to be heard. And I think Dominic Grieve said something along those lines earlier this week, and I agree with him. But what we can't do is have the situation where the Prime Minister essentially says, since no deal is so awful, you're going to have to vote for whatever I manage to bring back. I mean, that's a really hopeless position for us to find ourselves in.
And Katie, in a vote the government won by just three, we found out Vince Cable and Tim Farron were somewhere else. What are the Lib Dems doing? Surely their one policy is stopping Brexit.
Yeah, I think this is the question now. What are the Liberal Democrats for? This is absolutely spectacular. I was on the terrace on Monday evening and I was about to go home, but then suddenly you realise that the government were losing control and it all got very frantic. And everyone's like, no, the Remain rebels are really annoyed that the government have caved on these. They're going to vote against. And all the Labour MPs were getting very excited about the prospect of defeat, the Labour whips, the whips offers. And then they come out and obviously by an absolute whisker, the government have got through and it's because of the Lib Dems. And people were furious. I think this is going to haunt the Lib Dems for some time to come, even into the next election. Because if I were Labour, I'd just do an attack ad every time they said anything about the EU, pointing, you know, photos of that vote, people going into the lobbies and saying, this is why we got there, Vince Cable and Tim Farron.
Are there problems with the leadership at the moment, do we think, Jess?
I think that the fact that they misjudged this so badly is a real problem for Vince Cable. And I think, you know, they can make excuses, say we didn't realise it was going to be this close. People have been talking about these bills and the amendments on these bills for a long time now. And I just think if you're a Lib Dem whip or if you're the leader of the party, you should think, why would we risk this? I mean, we still don't exactly know where Vince Cable was, and I don't think he's actually apologised for it. And, you know, you get sort of a few the Dem spinners saying to you, oh, this is just a Westminster bubble story and it, you know, wouldn't have made a difference anyway. I think this is the sort of thing that kind of really resonates with people. When I tweeted it straight after the vote, my mentions were filled with hundreds of angry Lib Dems, like people who've got Lib Dem in their bio. This is like the thing that they care about the most. And I can't imagine something more damaging for them.
Just as all this was happening this week, the Electoral Commission dropped a stinging report on the conduct of vote leave during the 2016 referendum, didn't it, Jonathan?
This is an extraordinary story which has been brewing for a long time, and your own Carol Cadwallader has been absolutely amazing in sort of bringing this to light. And it's just a really interesting story because the government is completely trapped. Because how can you justify considering a referendum as the word of God when there has been flagrant cheating, when in all other walks of life, if you cheat at something, you get disqualified? I mean, it's not necessarily this idea that we must consider the referendum null and void, but the government needs to take things seriously, because if you have elections, you need rules. If you break the rules, that means you break the election. Otherwise, what's the point of having those rules, or indeed having elections anyway? And so really the government needs to answer what kind of law breaking by vote leave would be acceptable. £5 million, £10 million, any sum? And they can't answer that, and that could be a real problem for them.
Katie, should we rerun the referendum?
No. I think obviously these are really serious allegations, the serious findings, and some of them have been handed over to the police and there is an investigation going on there. So you have to see where that goes, and there should be penalties and consequences for those. But my gut feeling is that the referendum result wasn't won, basically, on, you know, a bit too much money going there. And you will also get the argument back that if you're going to look at the, you know, the odds being stacked against and the amount of money that the Remain campaign could use, the force of the government machinery, I don't think it will come down to this group of payments as the swinging factor that meant we got 52-48.
We're talking about some very senior government figures here, aren't we? We're talking about Michael Gove and others.
Yeah, and that raises serious questions about, obviously, their choices and their involvement and what they did there. And I think that is obviously something that they need to look at and will be investigated. But I think in terms of looking at purely from the referendum result, I don't think it's grounds to suddenly do a rerun.
No, I'm not saying that you need to have a rerun per se, but it asks incredibly important and serious questions about how we conduct democracy. Because if you're basically going to say that a reputation is the worst thing that can be demolished if you cheat exorbitantly in an election, then we have to ask, well, then why wouldn't anyone do it? You just set up a fool guy who's going to take the rap, might do some jail time, might have to pay a huge fine, and then the result stays.
I think one of the really interesting wider questions that this raises is that, like, Britain as a democracy doesn't do referendums that often. It's quite an unnatural thing for us to do. And so the way that they're run it's kind of been a bit of a wild west. And I think that's similar. It was a bit similar to the Scottish referendum as well. But particularly with the Brexit referendum, you can make claims and you don't have to deliver them in a manifesto. You can just, and that goes for both sides, you can just make whatever arguments you like because you're not voting in a set of people. And therefore, and you know, if people feel like they suddenly getting loads of donations pouring in, and there are rules obviously around it, but I think it just sort of underlines, you know, the problem, the tricky thing about referendums, particularly in a country that doesn't really do them very often.
And you also have ad hoc groups running them rather than political parties that have a lot, kind of long history of knowing how general elections work and how they're funded and all of that. Makes you wonder, doesn't it, whether a general election is more likely than another referendum should we get to the stage where none of this can be resolved in Parliament, which is quite possible, isn't it? What are the chances of another general election in the next year, Katie?
It does seem like it's something that keeps cropping up and likely in some degree, but at the same time, we have the Fixed Term Parliament Act and we have a group of Conservative MPs who are terrified at the prospect of an early election, partly because voters don't tend to like unnecessary elections. So to bring them about twice as a party, I think they are going to do everything they can to avoid it. I think it will get really, really choppy. I think there will be points when it probably should seem like we do have an early election, but I would say it's more likely than not that we won't.
Go on,
John. Well, I suppose if you have an election, I mean, what clearer sign to the EU that we're a country falling apart? We've already had one since we triggered Article 50. We're going to have another one just at the business end of Brexit. I mean, it's totally absurd. But of course, in Britain at the moment, that absurd doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And it could be the only way out. What I would say is that if you've had a referendum that kind of implements Brexit or that sort of starts the Brexit process, then there is a strong argument that you also need a referendum to get you out of Brexit as well, and that a general election might not resolve that. But if the Labour Party, for example, were to stand on a no Brexit platform, which seems extremely unlikely right now, then who knows?
I think one of the really interesting things about the 2017 general election is it didn't really seem to solve anything. And the arguments are still made that people voted Leave and they voted for this in 2016. And you never really hear the argument made again that in 2017, May basically put her Brexit plan, a harder version of a Brexit plan, to the British people.
She explicitly said, give me a mandate
to negotiate this kind of Brexit. And the British people didn't really give her much of a mandate to negotiate that. And yes, the election was about plenty of other things as well. But I don't think that in terms of knowing what kind of Brexit we should pursue or stopping Brexit, a general election didn't really seem to give us an awful lot of direction then. And so I don't really see why it would do again.
There's another solution mooted by Nicholas Soames in Parliament this week, wasn't there? Government of National Unity. We're all laughing, and it's not terribly likely, but it's really straining at the bonds of party loyalty, isn't it, on both sides of the House of Commons, this issue. You feel a little bit there are sort of renegade groups on all sides that could ultimately...
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a nice idea. I think we're also at the point now where I do think if we're going back to referendums, then I think people on both sides of the debate in the EU referendum would probably say with hindsight that it could have been improved. it could have been a bit clearer. We could have tried to get more what people were wanting rather than lots of different, you know, theories. And that would have meant it was less complicated now. Still be complicated. But I think Brexit is such a complicated process that really... party politics makes it even harder to do. And this idea, in a way, you know, in times of national crisis, and at the moment I don't think we are there, but we could be on the road to a national crisis depending on how this goes. You have seen in the past parties coming together for the good of the country, and I think that would be helpful to the situation, but I just don't think there's any way of it happening because everyone is completely divided on what is for the good of the country. So it's a nice idea argument by Nicholas Soames, but I can't see it happening at all.
The problem with it is that it's also quite a crafty way for soft Tories to split the Labour Party, because, you know, Soubry made it quite clear that she wouldn't expect to see Corbyn or the Labour front bench being part of this government of national unity. So this would split the Labour Party. It's a nonsense idea. It can't happen. We need a general election and preferably kicking the Tories out.
I mean, to have a government of national unity, you kind of need a Winston Churchill sort of figure who's a sort of unifying figure. Who's that? Who's it going to be? I can't think of a single person who could unite John McDonnell and Anna Soubry and Boris Johnson. I really don't know who that person could be.
On that depressing note, I think we should end. You can follow all our Brexit coverage live and throughout the summer at theguardian.com/politics.
Would you now, with the whole world watching, tell President Putin, would you denounce what happened in 2016, and would you warn him to never do it again?
All I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. President Putin, he just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
It was the moment that a former CIA director called nothing short of treasonous. After a dozen more US indictments of Russian spies for hacking the 2016 election, Donald Trump stood next to Vladimir Putin and told the world the investigation was a witch hunt and Putin had some very good ideas on how to deal with it. Well, I'm joined now by The Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief, David Smith, who was in the room at that extraordinary press conference in Helsinki. So, David, this extraordinary press conference with Putin this week, I mean, caused a huge backlash in the US, didn't it? And Trump tried to clarify some of his remarks, but what should we make of it?
It was extraordinary, and I was sitting on the third row and could almost have reached out to grab that football as Trump threw it to his wife, Melania. And when he claimed that Russia-US relations were the worst they'd ever been, but that until about 4 hours ago when he started talking, I heard some giggles among the White House press, but when he then went on to make his staggering remarks about the US intelligence agencies being just roughly the same level of trustworthiness as Vladimir Putin, there was a kind of stunned silence and everybody just carried on typing. It was utterly bizarre. And, you know, he's attempted all week to walk it back and in some ways messed up and made it worse. But I think his supporters, his base and most of the Republican Party are satisfied with those attempts to clean up. And so it will be business as usual. And, you know, he will survive this as he's survived every other scandal. But the mystery and intrigue over this relationship with Russia will continue.
And what's his motivation? What do you, you know, does he just like and respect Putin because he's a particular kind of leader? Or do you feel there's more to it than that?
I think there are two very powerful theories. And both of them might be true at the same time. One is that Trump despises anyone questioning the credibility of his election win. And we heard it during that press conference where he went rambling off about the Electoral College and beating Hillary Clinton and how brilliant it was. And there's quite a lot of media reporting in Washington that suggests, you know, he's just very thin-skinned about anyone suggesting he didn't win through his own merits and that Russia might have played a part. But the second theory, which also looks more and more persuasive, is that there was indeed collusion between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin. Clearly, there's already some evidence of at least attempted collusion when Donald Trump Jr. had a meeting with a Russian lawyer at Trump Tower in June 2016. And, you know, there are other people working on this who will tell you they feel there's a very strong case, even though we haven't yet seen in the public domain clear evidence of collusion. And then, yes, in addition to those two theories, there certainly is his tendency to gravitate towards autocrats and strongmen. But it's worth remembering, even someone like Kim Jong-un of North Korea, while he's lavished him with praise recently, other times he has been critical of Kim, whereas with Putin, there just seems to be a straight embrace throughout.
And the optics were terrible from here, weren't they? Because he sort of went straight from here where he'd been standing alongside Theresa May. There's been an attack on British soil recently, which the government's attributed to Russian interference. It's extraordinary, really, for those two things to happen in that way.
Well, in many ways, it was a catastrophic week of disruptive diplomacy, unlike anything we've seen from any American president to kick off at NATO, you know, haranguing them over this Russian pipeline to Germany and taking swipes at Angela Merkel. And then in the UK, it all seemed to be going swimmingly until he gave an interview to The Sun and undermined Theresa May and said what a great prime minister Boris Johnson would be. And then the Putin incident, it clearly fits a pattern of disrupting the post-war Western liberal democratic alliance and you know, siding with Russia on that score, and you never know with Trump whether that's just on the fly and an instinctive thing, or whether there is some really deep concerted effort here, and it's looking increasingly like the latter. I mean, it now fits so much of a pattern. I think also interesting to note, Trump appears to be a bit of a coward in public, in that. You know, he never seems to say these things to Angela Merkel's face.
Or to Theresa May's face, yeah.
Theresa May, he said one thing to The Sun when he was in the safety of a room in Brussels, but then standing on a public platform with Theresa May, he shrank away and virtually issued an apology with Putin. Perhaps he was a bit tougher behind the scenes, but again, when it came to the public display, it was very fawning and sycophantic. And that reminds me of just a few weeks ago after yet another summit where he was pretty cordial with Justin Trudeau in person, but then tweeted and stabbed him in the back from Air Force One. And it fits with a man who became famous on television for saying, "You're fired," but actually can never carry out firings in person. He tends to get rid of people via Twitter or a message sent by courier.
Presumably none of this will do him any harm with his base, Mogan voters, will it?
I don't think so. The Helsinki press conference was such a disaster and so condemned by some as even treasonous that the question was put again, well, will this finally be the straw that breaks the camel's back? Will this finally be the turning point that turns his supporters against him? But I see very little evidence of that. Whenever I go to a Trump rally, they're as loyal and fiercely pro-Trump as ever. And when you ask them about these controversies that are roiling Washington, they will always say, oh, I was pretty busy, I didn't really hear about that, or oh, that was background noise on the television, or oh, you know, Fox News are saying actually it's bad reporting by the media and Trump is doing great. And I suspect something like this issue, which is to do with international diplomacy and faraway Russia, will not penetrate. And indeed, it was interesting that so many Republicans were delighted Trump made at least some attempt to clean it up and came flocking back to the fold very quickly. And that includes, you know, the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich and others.
David Smith, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Katie Balls, Jessica Elgott, Jonathan Lee, David Smith. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.